This is Bang. Welcome to Mosh Pod. Today on Mosh Pod, dodgy practices. So many dodgy practices, so little time. We've decided to go for the Hobbit approach, that is, stretch one idea into three episodes. We had so many good pods for this one, so rather than cramming it all into one, we've gone for the three-parter. We've fished out a few from pod pools we haven't used on the show before to give you listeners a taste of some of the other pods we like. Now, these shows are generally less easy to use in our topical format, but you'll probably hear more of them when we move on to our fortnightly show. Now, keep the feedback coming and let us know if you like the pods we selected for this show. First up, we've got a usual suspect to get the ball rolling. This is Freakonomics from the 18th of July, 2013. Government employees gone wild. Links in the show notes. Move up or it's boss another.
Are you looking for a good beach read this summer? If so, I can help you. I've got just the book for you. It's got pretty much everything in it. Sex, crime, power struggles. It's got drug dealers and prostitutes, cheating scientists, Russian brides, even rogue real estate agents. And the best part? Every word is true. And oh yeah, it won't cost you a penny because it's already been paid for by your tax dollars. What is this magical book? It's called The Encyclopedia of Ethical Failure.
From WNYC, this is Freakonomics Radio, the podcast that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
So I am very pleased to present today the founding editor and current editor of one of the most unusual publications I have ever come across. It's called the Encyclopedia of Ethical Failure, and it's published by the United States Department of Defense. So, gentlemen, can I first ask you to introduce yourselves, please?
I'm Jeff Green. I'm a senior attorney in the Standards of Conduct Office as part of the Office of General Counsel here at the Department of Defense.
And that would make you the current editor of this publication, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
And I'm Steve Epstein. I used to work with Jeff at the Department of Defense. I've moved on now. I'm the Chief Counsel for Ethics and Compliance at the Boeing Company.
Very good. And that would make you the founding editor of the Encyclopedia of Ethical Failure, correct?
Yes.
So Epstein and Green are my new favorite authors. The Encyclopedia of Ethical Failure is meant to be a sort of manual, an ethics guide for government employees. Steve Epstein started it about 10 years ago.
There is a requirement that we train our senior officials and many other officials in the government every year. And the problem, of course, is keeping that training fresh, keeping it relevant. And to do that, we discovered the first thing you have to do is you have to entertain folks enough so they will pay attention.
And entertaining it is, because this encyclopedia is 160-odd pages of true stories about government employees who screwed up. Now, the chapter headings are helpful. You've got your fraud, gambling, conflicts of interest, abuse of position. And even though the book is published on the Department of Defense website, actually, it's not even really published. It's just sitting there as a Microsoft Word document for anybody to read. But anyway, the screw-ups that it chronicles are not limited to the Department of Defense. The stories come from all over the federal government. You've got the IRS represented, Veterans Affairs, government safety inspectors. Here's one entry. The headline is, "But Judge, I didn't get anything."
An offshore safety inspector found much of the government's equipment to be in need of repairs to meet safety standards. He then referred the business to his brother-in-law's repair shop. The rig operators smelled a rat and called the FBI. they discovered that in return for each referral, the brother-in-law was treating the inspector to an evening with a lady of dubious morals. The case was brought to trial. In his defense, the inspector claimed that he had not received a thing of value in return for the referral. The judge didn't buy it, and neither did his wife.
Now, it should be said that Epstein and Green are rather considerate in how they point their fingers. They don't always name names, and they don't include a story unless it's been settled with a conviction or a guilty plea or some other disciplinary measure. The stories are taken from media reports, press releases, and the inspectors general of other agencies.
There are so many favorites. I mean, it's like going to an ice cream shop and picking your favorite flavor. There's really no such thing. But the one that I always remember was an employee in actually DOD who was also a real estate agent. And she basically put on her real estate card, her business card, she put her phone number and address at the Pentagon.
Ooh.
And at her desk in the Pentagon, she would answer the phone, K&B Real Estate.
Even I could tell that's probably no go.
So, and this one, it sort of surprised us that she was so bold in basically taking her outside business and making it her primary business.
Now, I don't know how well you know the case, Steve, but do you have any recollection of or knowledge of what her response was when she was challenged on this, when she was caught on it?
Well, as a matter of fact, that's part of it. And yes, she was basically called and pointed out that she was misusing government office and her government resources to carry on her outside business, which is also prohibited by the rules. And she said, well, in that case, I'd rather be a real estate agent. And she quit.
Okay. Jeff, how about a favorite from you?
I like Steve. There's
so many
different ones, but one of the ones is actually was not involving a Defense Department employee. It involved the Drug Enforcement Agency, and they had an agent who was responsible for protecting a confidential source whose husband was a drug trafficker. And
I remember this one. I hate to say, this is unbelievable. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yes. He had a government vehicle. He was taking her to a cafe. He was taking her to the airport, and then got to the point where he was taking her to the hotel to go to bed with her, and he even was kind enough to give her some of his ammunition for her gun. You know?
So this is a DEA official who's got a confidential informant, and he's cheating on the informant's wife and giving her government bullets in a nutshell, yeah?
Yes, and one of the problems that the MSPB really went after him for was the misuse of the vehicle, which I thought was kind of funny.
Sex, as you may expect, is a common theme. But a plain old extramarital affair gets a lot more problematic in the military, where adultery is a crime. And you know what happens next, right? Like they say, the cover-up is always worse than the crime.
We had one involved a Navy officer who was in charge of a submarine, and he was married and was carrying on an affair with another woman, and he got her pregnant. And so he rigged up his email so that someone else sent her an email that said, well, he passed away in the service of his country. So she was so upset about it, she took her mother. They drove to his home in Virginia. And the new owner said, oh, he's fine. He's up in Connecticut. So they drove up, and all of a sudden they find out that it was all a ruse. And so to make a long story short, her sister contacted the Navy JAG office, and he will no longer be head of any kind of ship or commander of any sort. But
no, let me just ask you quickly, Jeff, what's worse there, the sex or the pretending to be dead?
The UCMJ, which is the law that governs military officers, prohibits that kind of activity. And in addition, pretending to be dead is a pretty draconian way of trying to solve the problem. It's another poor judgment, I think.
When we come back, you'll hear about an absolutely idiotic burglary, a creative use of religious leave, and a story about governmental red tape. Actual roles of governmental red tape.
From WNYC, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
The Encyclopedia of Ethical Failure, an ethics guide published by the Department of Defense, includes plenty of kickbacks and bribes, misuse of government funds, and what might be called the misuse of theology.
Some military members who were, instead of taking annual leave, which is the government's way of vacation time, they decided to bank everything under what they called religious leave. And whether it was going to the doctor, whether it was playing golf, they used it as religious leave. So at some point, someone found out about this and called the IG for an investigation. And when they were questioned about this, someone said, well, what did you think of golf as a religious experience? And the military member said, well, I think it certainly could be, you know. But they ultimately were dismissed and weren't able to take advantage of their religious leave.
I think it's only a religious experience when you hit the hole in one.
One thing that's astonishing is how lazy some scammers are about covering their tracks. Here, from the Encyclopedia of Ethical Failure, is an entry called It's 5 o'clock Somewhere.
A government employee attached to a service base in the United States ended up taking a permanent vacation after a pattern of working an abbreviated work week. The investigation showed the employee worked an average of 3 hours a day before leaving around 9 or 10 each morning to spend the rest of the day drinking in a local bar. The employee put in for retirement in lieu of disciplinary action.
And this one is called, What Do You Mean This Isn't My Property?
One entrepreneurial federal employee backed his panel van up to the office door one night and stole all the computer equipment. He wasn't too hard to catch. He tried to sell everything at a yard sale the next day, with barcodes and property of U.S. government stickers still prominently displayed.
I'm curious to know any observations that either of you have made over the years, whether they're empirical or anecdotal, on the different kinds of violations among different departments, maybe among even different political parties, male versus female, any kind of categorizing that you can help us with a way to think about how different violations sort of break down?
Well, I actually did a taxonomy of this several years ago.
Yeah. And
because I was intrigued by why, in most cases, good people make bad mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I found it didn't really relate to grade or rank or gender, but I found that at least within the government, where I think most of your people are trying to do the right thing, the predominant issue was at the moment they didn't think of the ramifications.
Mm.
It was an error in judgment of people who are generally well-meaning, but at the time they saw an advantage or they saw something which distracted them from what they should have been doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in most of the cases when you would sit down with these folks afterwards and say, what were you thinking? They would be banging their heads on the table and saying, you're right, I wasn't thinking.
Mm. Jeff and Steve, you both sound and on paper look like the kind of guys who would not have the jobs you have if you were the type who would make the kind of bad decisions that get made by the people who are in your book. But I'm still curious whether either of you have ever been on the border of doing something that may be just a little bit beyond the reach of good judgment and thought back to that story in your own Encyclopedia of Ethical Failure and helped yourself with your encyclopedia.
Well, I could emphatically say yes. And more than once.
Okay.
There are times when I would like to do something and I first of all check the legality of it and say, okay, I think this is legal. But then I step back and say, okay, now let's think about it one more time. How would this appear? You know, how would people challenge my judgment if this were disclosed? And then, you know, it comes into very much some of the stories we look at about that. And it causes me to back off.
Do either of you ever worry that this encyclopedia of ethical failure could be read not so much as a set of cautionary tales, but instead as a handbook for, oh, there's a something I hadn't thought of doing. There's a way to wrangle a little extra money or influence or whatnot.
Well, it's funny. Good point you raised there. I don't see that because in most of these cases, you see people who made very poor judgment calls. And they weren't very successful in a criminal manner. So it would hardly be a handbook for how to be a successful criminal. As a matter of fact, it's more of a handbook of how to be an unsuccessful criminal.
The lessons of the Encyclopedia of Ethical Failure are pretty straightforward and helpful whether you work in government or not. Don't steal stuff from your office and sell it at home in a yard sale. Don't spend all day in a bar if you're supposed to be working. Don't pay a kickback with hookers. And if you are going to do any of these things, don't lie about it and then pretend you're dead. It just won't work. Now, it's impossible to say how successful the encyclopedia has been, if at all, in preventing ethical failures. One thing it has going for it is that it tells stories. It doesn't dwell on the rule that gets broken. It tells us who does what, to whom and how, sometimes why. Nobody wants to read a set of rules, but all of us like a good story and will remember it too. With that in mind, I'll leave you with my favorite story from this wonderful book. This one's called Employees Fail to Profit from Red Tape.
Two workers at the Veterans Affairs Consolidated Mail Outpatient Pharmacy, which mails prescriptions to veterans, were charged with taking kickbacks for purchasing a product from a supplier at more than twice the normal price. The product? Red tape. The employees were charged with purchasing 100,000 rolls of the tape, which is stamped with the word security and is meant to deter tampering, at $6.95 a roll rather than its $2.50 retail value. In return, they received kickbacks of more than $1 per roll. The duo will have plenty of time to appreciate the irony of their situation as they face a sentence of 15 years in jail.
Okay, so we do like the Freakonomics boys, don't get us wrong. They put together a tight show, great stats, interesting stories, new perspectives on entrenched ideas, more power to them. And you will hear more of their stuff in future Mosh Pod. Having said all that, they are economists, they are of the system, for lack of a better term. And while I wouldn't say it's a right-wing show by any means, this podcast is made of more conservative DNA than most we draw from. So on that note, we want to take issue with this episode. Now, like us, you're probably intrigued and enticed by the idea of an encyclopedia of ethical failures, published by the US government, no less. And like us, you were on the edge of your proverbial seat waiting for the meat. But the stories were just soft. I mean, they were all right. Captain Nemo killing himself off to dodge some chicken stuff. Pretty funny. But anyone that keeps up to date with current events could probably reel off three examples just off the top of their head where the unethical actions of government employees made every example in this show seem super tame. Now, if I was of a conspiratorial mindset, I'd say the whole government-published encyclopedia and any media promoting it is just part of a smokescreen campaign to draw attention away from the real and serious ethical fails that government employees make every day, ethical fails that make real people suffer. So on that note, this next pod is a real example of one of those ethical fails, complete with victim. This is a brutal story. We've taken it from one of my favourite podcasts, Common Sense, with Dan Carlin. Now, I think I do say that a lot, but put it this way, when his show hits the new streams, it's always on the top of my listening list. You might remember Dan from our second show. He's also the dude behind Hardcore History. His shows are hard for us to use in this format. They're usually pretty long, broad range, and Dan is all over the place, really. But it is gold, and I love it. It is very US-centric too, but I can pretty much guarantee, as a non-American, if you listen to just three new Common Sense episodes in a row, your understanding of US politics and the social and economic forces behind them will increase exponentially. Now, enough of all that. Let's get to the meat. This is an excerpt from Common Sense 264, Speak No Evil. Links, as usual, are in the show notes.
You know, there is one last story I wanted to deal with today, but it's a little gross. So if you happen to be eating breakfast or anything like that, have the kids in the car, I turn this show off now. But the reason I feel the need to share it with you is because I feel like it does a great job, you know, answering one of those questions that people like yours truly constantly have thrown in our face when we talk about, you know, opposition to too much spying and surveillance and whatnot. You know, we called it the auto principle on the last show for Ben's mythical dad. And it's the idea of, you know, if you're not doing anything wrong, what have you got to hide? And this story I want to share with you right now is a wonderful example. And remember, an early example. This is where we're on the road to. These kinds of things become more common and worse as time goes on. A wonderful example of why that argument doesn't hold water. Because there are people out there who have nothing to hide at all, but as our, you know, ability to shield ourselves behind the veil of protection that things like the Constitution provides us, you begin to see exactly what can happen to you when those protections, you know, become too full of loopholes. In this case, it involves a guy named David Eckert in New Mexico. Now, we should say at the outset, Mr. Eckert is suing, and he's suing the city of, I guess it's Deming, New Mexico. He's suing police officers. He's suing deputies. He's suing the deputy district attorney. And he's suing the regional medical center for what they did to him. He wants a lot of money, obviously. And what they did to him is the best response you folks will ever hear to, if you have nothing to hide, what do you care? And you may have heard about this story. And, you know, it tends to appear in I mean, the funniest thing is the best rundown of what happened to this guy was printed in the Huffington Post. So that's the one I'm using. And remember, these are allegations because he's filing a suit, but apparently he and his lawyer have quite a bit of you know, evidence and people who were involved in this, including doctors maybe who are willing to testify on his behalf. Listen to this story and think about how this could happen to anyone. And then think about how the officials involved in this case thought this was just fine. From the beginning of the piece, appeared in the Huffington Post, November 5th, 2013, and it's entitled, David Eckert appears to clench his buttocks, cops order enemas, colonoscopy, x-ray for non-existent drugs. From the beginning of the piece, quote, it's not funny. A New Mexico man is alleging abuse after authorities conducted three enemas, a colonoscopy, an x-ray, and several cavity searches on him simply because he appeared to clench his buttocks. David Eckert's attorney recently filed a federal lawsuit on his behalf over the January 3rd incident in which police and doctors co-opted in a quote-end-quote unethical 14-hour series of cavity searches, KOB Channel 4 reports. It says court documents state that Eckert was driving out of Walmart in Deming when he failed to fully stop at a parking lot stop sign. He was immediately pulled over. The story says, quote, when he stepped out of his vehicle, an officer reported that he appeared to be clenching his buttocks. That fact was cited as probable cause to suspect that Eckert was hiding narcotics in his anal cavity. Officers obtained a search warrant, and Eckert's humiliating examination began at a nearby medical center. All right, if you're not going to turn this off, push the cornflakes to the other side of the table. You have to hear what happened to this guy and realize this is the actual result of things like the Fourth Amendment going by the wayside. This can happen to you, and there's no reason that this won't continue to slide down this road so it happens more often and in more extreme ways. From KOB Channel 4, quote, Eckert's abdominal area was x-rayed. No narcotics were found. Number two, doctors then performed an exam of Eckert's anus with their fingers. No narcotics were found. Number three, doctors performed a second exam of Eckert's anus with their fingers. No narcotics were found. Number four, doctors penetrated Eckert's anus to insert an enema. Eckert was forced to defecate in front of the doctors and police officers. Eckert watched as doctors searched his stool. No narcotics were found. Number five, doctors penetrated Eckert's anus to insert an enema a second time. Eckert was forced to defecate in front of doctors and police officers. Eckert watched as doctors searched his stool. No narcotics were found. Number six, doctors penetrated Eckert's anus to insert an enema a third time. Eckert was forced to defecate in front of doctors and police officers. Expert watched as doctors searched his stool. No narcotics were found. Number seven, doctors then x-rayed Eckert again. No narcotics were found. Number eight, doctors prepared Eckert for surgery, sedated him, and then performed a colonoscopy, where a scope with a camera was inserted into Eckert's anus, rectum, colon, and large intestines. No narcotics were found. Some of these stories say he was then given a $6,000 bill for all the work done on him. Now, let me just say that these are allegations, supposedly bolstered with a bunch of evidence. We'll see. But if true, this is perhaps the most shocking part of the story. Deming Police Chief Brandon Gigante argued that his officers, quote, follow the law in every aspect, end quote. Well, folks, if that's procedure, if that's okay, and it looks like, from what I'm reading here, that they went to a judge and said, okay, we think he's clenching his buttocks, and supposedly they thought he was hiding marijuana. So we're not even talking like heroin stuff here. This is going to be, we're going to have a guy who wants to smoke marijuana for personal use, and where does he hide it? Well, you know, just if I'm traveling around town, that's where I put it. Apparently a judge signed off on this idea that he may be hiding marijuana because he's standing funny, and that makes 14 hours of jailhouse check-in searches, or worse than that, okay and legal. If you have nothing to hide, what do you care? I don't know. I don't want to go through 14 hours of hell like that guy. So when we talk about these being important issues, folks, we're not talking about things getting out of hand down the road. They're out of hand now, and they're worse than they were 5 years ago. Where are they going to be 5 years from now? That's what lines in the sand are supposed to protect. These ideas of constitutional rights is not some amorphous thing that shouldn't matter to you that seems like something you'll never need. David Eckert's wishing he'd had them in place with more authority, you know, back January 3rd when he got pulled over. Might not have helped him, though. Looks like maybe a judge agreed that, hey, listen, clenching your buttocks, I mean, anybody who does that, yeah, search him for 14 hours with colonoscopies. The good news about this is some people still have some sort of a code. According to Eckert, the first doctor that they took him to try to have everything searched and colonoscopies and everything said no, that it was unethical. And apparently he may be one of the people willing to testify that that's what the doctors were asked to do by the police officers. We'll see where this goes, and I'll try to keep you up to date. But to me, that's the best answer that I can freely and easily name to say, you know, if you have nothing to hide, what do you care? Well, protecting yourself from unreasonable search and seizure may sound like nothing, you know, that big of a deal in high-minded concept. Saying you don't have a right to search my anal cavity under most conditions, that hits a little bit closer to home, don't you think?
Ouch. Ouch, ouch, ouch. Well, pucker up, listeners, because we've got another new pod to introduce. This one is called The Good Fight, It's quite new. It's an official podcast of change.org. If you don't know them, go and check out their website, change.org. It's the world's largest petition platform. It's pretty amazing. You go straight to the Australian page, if you're in Australia, and you'll be able to view petitions that people are trying to get going. Some might be very relevant to you, and they've had some big successes, so it's definitely worth checking out. We're giving you a cut from episode 3 of The Good Fight. Links are in the show notes. It's an interview with Ethan Nadelman of the Drug Policy Alliance. Now, don't worry, you don't need to know who he is. We didn't. But it's all about this guy that spent the last 30 years trying to fight a war on the war on drugs. We think the war on drugs and total drug prohibition is a pretty dodgy practice, pretty counterproductive. So here's a great in-depth interview about it. We've also left a little bit in the beginning, some corporate dodgy practices by our friends at Walmart and McDonald's. Enjoy.
People have been stepping up and saying, we're not getting paid a living wage, but these companies are making millions. So
billions.
We have billions of dollars. Like billions of dollars off of our backs, but they say that they can't afford to pay us a living wage. And then some of them have the audacity, like our friends at Walmart, to say, you know what? We have a big heart. So we know that it's the holidays. We know that it's tough to feed your family on what we pay you or don't pay you. So Walmart in Northeast Ohio, this one store, actually had a canned food drive. But it wasn't for members of the community. It wasn't for homeless people in Northeast Ohio. No, it was for Walmart employees. So Walmart employees at Walmart got to give their other Walmart employee buddies cans of food to try to feed them for the holidays.
Let's just hear the news clip on this.
Walmart in Canton, Ohio is stirring up controversy by holding a Thanksgiving food drive for their employees. This is a photo taken in an employee-only area of the store. The sign reads, please donate food items here so associates in need can enjoy Thanksgiving dinner. It sparked a debate over whether Walmart workers are underpaid. Walmart says the drive is about company spirit and co-workers helping each other out, and they don't plan on canceling the drive.
Walmart employees are referred to as associates. So this is, you know, associates helping associates instead of Walmart paying its employees like any decent employer ought to. God, it's just embarrassing and ridiculous.
I understand that this is the holiday season and the spirit of giving and cheer and happiness and big food. But you know what? The best way to have a good holiday is to have your employee actually pay you a living wage. Yep. But Walmart isn't alone in this and doing ridiculous things around the holidays. McDonald's, another huge multi-billion-dollar corporation that they've decided that they would create a McResources website. That is not a joke. It is called McResources.
McResources.
Ronald McDonald will help you get resources. They try to give their employees advice on how to cope with the poverty wage that McDonald's decides to pay them. What's the advice they give them? Sleep on it. Get more exercise. Live a healthier lifestyle, and it'll be more awesome for you while you're broke because we don't pay you enough.
Thank you, McDonald's, for all those McResources.
It is amazing in how insulting it is, and it's just disgusting. And that's why I'm so inspired by the low wage workers who are stepping up, taking action, fighting back against these huge corporations. And you know, we're proud as Move On to be supporting those organizers who are doing this work in all these states, and we want to make sure that these companies feel pain for the way that they are inflicting pain on their employees.
This is the thing, is that, you know, there are workers across the country who are standing up right now. The National Labor Relations Board ruling is about employees who actually protested. There's a wave of Black Friday protests happening at Walmart stores across the country the day after this program is released, the day after Thanksgiving. There is a real pushback, and it's changing the national conversation. And finally, the government is stepping in to say you cannot retaliate against employees for standing up to, you know, things that they have the basic right to do. That is good. There will be a lot of wins and a lot of losses on the way to justice for low-wage employees in this country, but this is totally a step in the right direction. We come now to today's epic story. You're on The Good Fight. If you have a small child around who's listening, you might want to invite them to leave, because today's epic story is about drugs. And it's about drugs because something is happening at last. So we all know that drugs can be devastating, especially for people who are addicted. We also know that most people who try drugs, especially adults, don't get addicted. And we also know that the drug war, our society's response to drugs, has been a total disaster for decades running. The good news is that it's starting to shift, and we're seeing changes both in public opinion and in laws at the state and local level towards a more rational and sane policy. Now, we don't know how this is going to play out. We don't know where it's going, but we do know that we're only making these changes because there are people who've been fighting for them. And today's guest is one of those people. Ethan Nadelman, the head of the Drug Policy Alliance, has been at the center of many of the fights, pretty much all of the fights, to change our drug laws since the war on drugs began. Now, you might have this vision in your head of drug policy advocates being kind of Cheech and Chong figures who, you know, basically want to legalize their closetfuls of marijuana plants. That's not this guy. Ethan Nadelman has an undergraduate degree from Harvard, a law degree from Harvard, a PhD from Harvard, a master's degree from the London School of Economics, a ridiculous number of degrees. He was an assistant professor at Princeton before he left to start the Drug Policy Alliance, and he actually worked during the Reagan administration for the U.S. government, looking at drug laws around the world. So this is not a guy who can be dismissed easily. He also speaks kind of bracingly about the fact that he's a casual drug user himself. But he has a story really from the inside of the drug fight that I found fascinating. And I think you'll enjoy it as well. Whether or not you agree with everything he says, you'll learn a lot. Ethan Nadelman for today's epic story here on The Good Fight. Welcome to the show, Ethan.
Thanks. It's great to be on.
Let's start with you. How did you get started thinking about all this stuff?
Well, I mean, I guess it goes back to my my late teens. I mean, I was only 12 when the 60s ended, which means I came of age in the sort of live and let live 70s. And I'd grown up in a fairly traditional middle-class Jewish family. My dad was a rabbi. My mom came from an Orthodox family. Go off to college, actually, at McGill in Montreal in the mid-70s. And, you know, I'd been drinking beer and stuff already, but I started smoking marijuana. Actually, it was hash back then because Montreal had more of that. And, you know, I enjoyed it. It wasn't a problem. I had lots of friends. We would get high. A couple of people, obviously, you know, were using it in a foolish kind of way. But it was so obvious that marijuana was relatively less harmful than alcohol for many people. Yet some people were getting busted at the border, getting arrested. We had to hide. I mean, the whole thing struck me as something just wrong with that.
Okay, so you're in college. You try marijuana. Your life does not turn into a fireball.
No, it was just enjoying it. And then, but also, you know, I'd always been interested in politics and I'd grown up in a fairly ethical, moral background. And there seemed to be something immoral about the laws that would take away my freedom or kick me out of school or whatever it might be simply for smoking marijuana in the absence of any harm to anybody else. And I remember a year later in a political philosophy class writing a 50-page paper on John Stuart Mill's classic book On Liberty. You know, and his basic distinction between self-regarding acts and other-regarding acts, that those acts which are primarily self-regarding, which only basically mostly involve yourself, are none of the state's business. Whereas those ones that are other-regarding, where you do harm to others, there's a proper role for the state. So that kind of registered. You know, I transferred to Harvard. A few years later, I'm graduate school, law school, trying to think about what I want to do. And I got intrigued by the whole issue of international crime and policing and law enforcement, but I was mostly interested in this drug issue, and I wasn't taking my academic career very seriously. I mean, the people who were doing traditional subjects, you know, on security studies, mainstream economic studies, and my deciding that I would, like, look at drugs and crime and write a PhD at Harvard on that, people kind of looked a bit askance at that, but I got enough support to say, what the hell, I'll go do it.
Yeah.
I got myself a security clearance in the State Department's Narcotics Bureau. I wrote a classified report in the mid-80s for the State Department's Narcotics Bureau about international money laundering stuff. I got some other grants, and I went all around Europe and Latin America interviewing DEA agents and foreign drug enforcement agents.
Drug enforcement.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Like in 19 countries, I interviewed like a couple hundred drug enforcement agents. I got to know more about international drug enforcement than a lot of the agents themselves did.
And this is while you were working for the government. You were doing
I worked for the government for about 9 months of that 3 or 4 years of research.
Yeah. So you went around and you just discovered actually all your concerns were misplaced. The war on drugs was working fine. Is that right?
You know, basically, no? I got to say, I was almost like undercovering the undercover agents, right? I went into this already being very skeptical about drug policy, already thinking that marijuana should be legal, already thinking that, you know, these harsh policies didn't make sense for the other drugs. I wasn't sure what the solutions were. And then you get into the government and you meet people. You meet the DA guys. You know, you talk to DA guys and you ask, what do you really think? And some of them, you know, quietly say, well, we should probably legalize it. Others of them are real gung-ho drug warriors. Others are saying, it's just a job. And, you know, one day my kid will have a job in this area. But it was fascinating. And it was also interesting to see how little people in the government really understood about drugs or drug policy or the origins of the drug laws. Huh. That was telling.
What didn't they get?
Well, first of all, they didn't know anything about drugs. I mean, you'd hear people making jokes about, like, you know, psychedelics or LSD or mushrooms. They didn't know anything about the issue, right? The whole notion about how the drug laws came about in the first place and the racist origins of the drug law, did not know it. People essentially ceased to think about what these laws were about or what they were originally intended to do, either from a benevolent perspective or a malevolent perspective.
Let's take a quick detour. So where did these laws come from?
Well, if you ask, you know, the question, have we always had drug prohibition? The answer is obviously no. I mean, there's nothing about drug prohibition that's in the Bible or Hammurabi's code or anything like that. You go to the, you know, mid to late 19th century, many of the drugs like opium, heroin, cocaine, et cetera, were legal. I mean, cigarettes were illegal in some states, especially for women. And then we had alcohol prohibition, right? But you know what part of it was? If you ask who were the principal consumers of morphine or other opiates in the 1870s, the answer, by and large, was middle-class white women. By and large, bad sanitation, opiates helped stop you up. You know, there was no Motrin, there was no penicillin, there was bad sanitation.
They were drugs in the other sense of the word drugs. And doctors used to prescribe all these drugs, right?
They prescribed them, but you could even get them over the counter, right? I mean, Loudenin was a liquid opium, right? And probably a higher percentage of the population back then used these drugs, but with dramatically fewer problems. So almost no problems on the crime side, relatively fewer health problems, but nobody thought about making it illegal because nobody was keen on putting auntie or grandma behind bars, right? It's when the consumers shift to being primarily Chinese people coming over to work on the railroads and the mines and working 90 hours a week and going back to their tents or dormitories and smoking up a little opium like they did in the old country, that's when you get the first opium prohibition laws in Nevada and California.
Huh.
The first cocaine prohibition laws were in the South in the beginning of the 20th century and directed at black men taking cocaine, you know, and the white fear that these black men taking this white powder up their black noses and forgetting their proper place in society, you know, and that's when you get cocaine being criminalized. Marijuana directed at Mexican Americans and Mexican migrants in the teens, 20s, and 30s, you know, in the western states, some of the southwestern states, once again, the same fear of white people about what happens when these darker skinned people start taking these funny smelling or funny looking drugs, right? So I think it's important to understand the extent to which the origins of drug prohibitions are not about the relative dangers of drugs, right? If you get a scientific panel together, a National Academy of Science, they're not going to tell you that alcohol and tobacco are safer than methamphetamine or cocaine or heroin, right? They're not going to tell you that. That's not what the science shows. By and large, if you want to understand why some drugs are illegal and some drugs are not, it has almost everything to do with who uses those drugs and who is perceived to use those drugs, and dramatically less with the relative harms of those drugs.
You know, my dad grew up on a prison farm for drug addicts called Narco in Kentucky. His dad, my grandfather was an addiction researcher. So my dad, they had a little house on the farm, and my dad grew up around all these like Chinese opium addicts and jazz musicians from New York who were in jail for using heroin.
There were two federal narcotics farms in Lexington, Kentucky, and Fort Worth, I think, was the other one. There was a point, I think, back in the 40s or 50s when you could have put together the single best jazz band in America from the inmates in these federal narcotics farms. I mean, up from the Billie Holidays of the world to a whole range of others, that whole cast of famous jazz musicians, both black and white, who got, you know, connected with heroin and, you know, landed up in these places.
That's right. My dad would see, they would do a concert on every Sunday. Mm-hmm. And musicians who sometimes were really rivals in the outside world would play together at the farm. And if anyone had recorded those, they would be like absolutely pure gold.
Oh, no. It's a fantastic history.
Okay, so this is the racist history of these laws. And the DEA agents you met didn't know this history. You would learn them as a scholar when you're studying. I mean, one of the things you see is that after the laws come into place, then the drugs become a gigantic problem. And so, you know, if you're in a community that's afflicted by like a drug epidemic and all the things that come with it in our society, then naturally,
well, that's like right, of course. But what happens? I mean, and this, I guess, is part of the story, right? I mean, you get to the late 1980s, and I've been working on this in the early and mid 80s when the drug issue was not a huge issue. But you get to the late 1980s, especially around 86, and you begin to get the crack cocaine epidemic and the death of the famous basketball player Len Bias in a cocaine overdose. And then you get Ronald Reagan and people around him seeing the political benefit of launching a drug war. George Bush becoming president, having a national speech, holding up a baggie of cocaine on national television. So we hit a period in the late 1980s when the drug war hysteria just went crazy. It was as if McCarthyism had reared its ugly head in America again, but this time it was in the guise of a drug war. And so the most draconian, absurd laws at the federal level, the state level, Democrats being afraid of being outflanked by the Republicans, there were people who were attending and sitting on the edges of these meetings in Capitol Hill. And, you know, you'd have one member of Congress say, well, I think we should increase the penalty for crack cocaine to 5 years and $50,000. So no, make it 10 years and $100,000. No, make it 25 years. I mean, it was like people gambling where the chips had no real value. Nobody was doing any cost-benefit studies about what this would cost fiscally. Nobody was trying to look at whether or not these tougher laws would actually make a difference or what negative consequences they would be. So we launched this hysterical policy. A lot of what my work, man, has been about over the last 25 years has been about trying to unravel the crazy hysteria of what we did in the late 1980s.
So you went from studying and interviewing all these people to becoming an advocate. What was the moment?
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, I remember even when I was studying this stuff, I remember in 85, I was still in graduate school. I was in, 27, 28 then. And I remember writing a piece, my first piece critiquing the drug war. So I sent it to Commentary Magazine. Norman Podhoretz was the famous conservative editor of that. And he wrote back, a nice note saying, very well argued, but I remain firmly on the other side. But then what happened in 87 is I finished my PhD. I go and start teaching at Princeton. And I write a piece basically about the futility of America's war on drugs, about how it's not working, it's ineffective, it's costly, it's counterproductive, and suggesting it's also immoral. And that piece gets published in Foreign Policy magazine in the spring of 88, at the peak of drug war hysteria. And at the same time, roughly the same time, the new mayor of Baltimore, Kurt Schmoke, been African-American, former Rhodes Scholar, former chief prosecutor, he comes out at the Conference of Mayors and says more or less the same thing. And around the same time, The Economist magazine, for the first time, comes out saying more or less the same thing. And none of us are saying legalize all drugs. We're just saying the war on drugs has failed. A major part of our drug problem is a failed prohibitionist policy. We need to put new approaches on the table. All of these three things, me and Mayor Schmoke and The Economist, each happening independently of one another. But they sort of come together. And I'm a first-year assistant professor at Princeton. I'm 31 years old. And all of a sudden, I got my 15 minutes of fame, on all the major national television programs, front of the media, as is Kurt Schmoke. I'm sort of the Princeton professor. He's the politician. And we're sort of out there, together with some famous conservatives like William Buckley and Milton Friedman, and then with Ira Glasser, who was then the head of the ACLU.
Not Ira Glass from This American
Life. No. Ira Glasser, who ran the ACLU. Yeah. And, a few other reputable people. But we're sort of being played for yucks. It's kind of like everybody supports the drug war. And here's this Baltimore mayor, this Princeton professor, a couple of right-wing, Friedman and Buckley, the ACLU. And they're saying, well, maybe we should legalize or decriminalize. Listen to their argument for 2 minutes, and then let's get back to the drug war. And for me, it was kind of like, I mean, my God, you read the history, you read the scientific journals, you look at the evidence, you look at people around you. If I ask myself, why did I land up committing my life to this thing? I mean, I guess two big influences. My father was a rabbi. My uncle was a professor. I didn't want to be a rabbi. I wanted to be a professor, but I also realized that I didn't want – so much of academia seems about pursuing intellectually interesting questions, but then the rest of it's a lot about posturing and such, especially in the non-hard sciences. And I realized that on some level, I needed my intellectual pursuits to be connected to something that I cared about personally and politically. right? And what struck me about this issue, first of all, I had a personal connection. And so on some level, I shared something in common with the large numbers of black and brown people who were being persecuted in the name of the drug war. Now, I was much less likely to be persecuted as a middle, upper middle class, white, academic, you know, all this sort of stuff. But on some level, right, I was part of that world of people violating the drug war, right? The second part of it was, if you looked at the historical, scientific, empirical, all that evidence, public policy should have looked like one thing. But if you looked at the real world, it was almost a 180 the other direction. And that was itself an intellectual puzzle, right? Why was it that all the evidence suggested one would be good, but the public and the politicians were the other way? That seemed like an intellectual puzzle. And I think the last thing was, I think I wanted to be connected to something that was bigger in our society, you know, and what was that cause going to be? Gay rights was just emerging, but I'm not gay and I empathize with it, but it wasn't my thing, right? The civil rights thing and now hit the point of being much more complex battle, right? And drug policy reform did not even exist as yet as a movement. And so I think that combination of personal connection, the intellectual puzzle, and the ability to begin to work on a political cause or movement or transformation from the ground up, really at starting at home plate on this thing, I think all those things came together in a way that was mostly subconscious back in those days. And only upon reflection in more recent years do I realize that's what was going on.
Yeah. Huh. I think it's so often that way that you just start doing something and you can put the puzzle pieces together in hindsight.
I think that's right. I think that's right. Yeah.
So you found this issue. You wrote your article. You had your 15 minutes along with these other folks. And you didn't win off the bat.
Well, I mean, I have to say, right from the get-go, I knew that even though this policy was crazy and inconsistent, that we were at the beginning of what was going to be a multi-generational struggle. I knew it was going to be a process of taking this apart block by block, unraveling things, fighting at the federal and state and local level, changing public consciousness, awaiting the emergence of new generations who are not beholden to the drug war thinking of the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So I always understood that. And that, I thought, was just the way it was and no reason not to get involved.
You had a lifetime. Why not spend it in a fight that mattered?
Exactly. And also what began to happen late 1980s was the emergence of a group of people, some in academia, some were in the marijuana area, some were in the issue of criminal justice reform, some were working on trying to stop the spread of the HIV virus, you know, what's called harm reduction approach. And so people began to come together. There was an organization created in the late 1980s called the Drug Policy Foundation, founded by two guys, a professor at American University, Arnold Treback, and a criminal defense lawyer named Kevin Zeese. And they brought a lot of us together. So we began to realize there was this wonderful group of people, both in the U.S. and internationally, working on this. And we liked one another. Most of the people coming into this movement were doing it for the right reasons. They were good people. And so, you know, we began to get going. And then at Princeton, I was able to pull together a working group of distinguished academics from around the country to try to think through what would, in theory, be the optimal drug policy. And so I kept pursuing that intellectual side of things. And then, you know, what happened in 1992, I remember it was the summer of 92, and one day I get a phone call inviting me to lunch with George Soros. Now, many of your listeners will know that George Soros is a very famous philanthropist and one of the richest men in America. Back in 92, he was already quite rich, and he wasn't that famous. But I looked him up, and I remember saying to my wife at the time, you know, this meeting could change my life. And I went in and met with, you know, George Soros on some 100-degree day in New York City, and we had lunch, and we argued for 2 hours. And at the end of that, he looks at me, and he says, well, look, I see we basically agree on the core issues. We'll have our differences. Now, I'm a very busy man, but I have substantial resources. So let's assume what I want to do is empower you to accomplish our common objectives, right? And I kind of laughed, went home, sent him a proposal. A year later, we shook hands on a deal. And a year later, I left Princeton in the summer of 94 to create what has now become, you know, the Drug Policy Alliance, my organization.
Wow. Huh. I didn't realize that's how it happened. So basically, you'd been in this fight. And then an opportunity to actually have the resources to go to bat.
Yeah, I'd been in it for 4 years at Princeton as a professor, writing, speaking. I was already traveling the country and the world speaking about this stuff, pulling together intellectuals to think through the optimal policy. I was beginning to meet the other emerging activist networks. But the thing that was really transformative, I think, in many respects, or that helped catapult this, was my meeting George Soros and him basically saying, I like these things you're saying in writing. Here's the money to put behind those ideas, and let's get going.
So George Soros is an advocate for the concept of an open society in general. And I think a lot of Americans don't realize that a lot, I think most of his giving has been outside the U.S. to things like the Central European University and, you know,
well, if you think about it, I mean, you know, George Soros is giving away, what, in the area of $800 million a year. And of that, probably more than three-fourths is going internationally. He is undoubtedly the leading financial supporter of human rights in the world, leading funder of efforts to fight xenophobia. He is credited by many people across the political spectrum as the private individual who did more to bring about the downfall of socialist dictatorship in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe than anybody else. I mean, this was the guy providing a laptop computer to every dissident in Czechoslovakia or a Xerox machine for every library in Hungary. This was the guy keeping Soviet scientists, when they all lost their jobs, when the ruble lost its value, keeping them going through a cold winter. I mean, this is the guy who has been funding sort of revolutions for democracy, freedom, and capitalism, for that matter, around the world. It's always funny to see the right wing in America banging up on Soros for being such a left winger, when what I happen to know about George Soros is, first of all, he was the major contributor to bringing down socialist dictatorship more than any right-wing philanthropist or anybody else in America. That secondly, although George regards himself primarily as a progressive and a liberal, he's got a strong libertarian streak. And I think what he saw about the drug war was that it was in some respect a bubble as well. It was the analogy to a bubble, but in the policy and political and moral world. But in this case, it wasn't about markets. It was something else. And that it had to pop. Now, in this case, it wasn't going to pop and come crashing down the way markets do, but that there was some inherent contradictions to this. I think on another level, though, if you think about it, if you ask the question, what's the closest thing to socialist dictatorship in America today, it's the war on drugs. What else assumes that you need to view common citizens, adult citizens, as children, and where the state needs to police them for their own benefit? What else relies so heavily on the use of informants, undercover operations, mass surveillance? What other issue did you have that until recently you were not allowed to engage in sort of open and honest dialogue, and where people who called for reform were demonized? For George, somewhat, and certainly for me, I define this struggle, and I'm primarily interested in this. I see myself first and foremost as a human rights activist, right? This is for me first and foremost a human rights struggle in which racial justice and injustice happens to play a major role. But there are at the same time these public health aspects, these financial, fiscal, you know, responsibility aspects, public security aspects that also play a role. That really is what this struggle is about.
And incarceration is the other huge part of this thing, right?
Well, it's part of it. I mean, look, it's arrests. It's 1.5 million Americans getting arrested each year for drugs, half of them for nothing more than possessing a small amount of marijuana, and another quarter for possessing some other drug for their personal use. It's incarceration, where we've gone from 50,000 people behind bars on a drug charge in 1980 to 500,000 today, and where America now has the highest incarceration rate in the world. I mean, you know the numbers, right? Less than 5% of the world's population, but almost 25% of the world's incarcerated population. The most incarcerated society in the history of democratic societies, and a rate of incarcerating black men in this country that puts apartheid South Africa, I mean, makes them look like, you know, a walk in the park in comparison. So it is the incarceration issue. It's also the public health issue. I mean, we essentially let 250,000 Americans die of HIV related to injection drug use because we were unwilling, for moralistic reasons, to implement needle exchange and other programs in the way that other civilized countries did. So it's about incarceration, it's about arrests, it's about racial injustice, it's about public health, and it's about a lot more.
So let's go to the fights. The Drug Policy Alliance has launched, and maybe sort of fast forward towards the present, because we are in this moment when the politics around this, the public opinion around this, is really shifting. You've been plugged in directly to this kind of work to make that happen. What's the sort of battle in this space in the last few years that gets you the most fired up?
I mean, I actually have to say there's two, right? I mean, the first one is what's going on with marijuana. It's so incredibly exciting. We've gone from having 23% of Americans supporting the legalization of marijuana in the mid-'80s to 58%, beginning with the legalization of medical marijuana in 96 in California, and now we have 20 states which have legalized medical marijuana, and then Colorado and Washington voting to legalize marijuana last year, and now Uruguay looks to become the first country to do it sometime in November 2013. And I have been involved in many, perhaps most of those battles. So seeing that remarkably rapid transformation in this marijuana issue, that's just incredibly exciting. I've always been very wary of saying we're at the tipping point, because you can only say that so many times before you lose your credibility. But I do say that 2013 is the tipping point on marijuana. Because the Obama and the Justice Department have given a qualified green light for these states to implement these laws, and because of the public opinion polls, I mean, what I see is we are at a tipping point. With a caveat that marijuana is not going to legalize itself. We have to be very responsible and mature about this thing. One of the greatest threats right now is if young people start to think, oh, it's all legal, it's all fine, even though it's not technically any more legal for them now than it was before we legalized it for adults. You know, the opponents are going to seize on that. But the other issue, you know, is the issue of mass incarceration, because that's the fundamental human rights issue in America. I mean, let's face it. If our incarceration rates in America were closer to the global average, and if another country locked up their people at the rate we do, we would point our fingers at that other country and describe them as a massive violator of human rights. But here we are in America, and we don't like to see ourselves as massive violators of human rights. But that is, in fact, what we're doing. And in that case, I don't think we're at the tipping point. I'd say maybe we're at a turning point. But turning around mass incarceration in America, it's a little like trying to turn around an ocean liner. Even when you start to point in a new direction, it takes a long time before it really is pointed in a new direction. You know, probably our biggest success on this was in 2000 when we passed a ballot initiative in California that basically said you can't throw people in prison right away who've been, you know, arrested for drug possession. You have to give them options of treatment. My biggest defeat was in 2008 when we put an initiative on the ballot that had overwhelming support going in that would have reduced the California prison population by 25,000 nonviolent drug offenders, that would have shifted $1 billion a year from prison and parole to treatment and rehabilitation. But in the final months, the Prison Guards Union allied with the political establishment, mobilized forces, raised money, and they kicked our butts. It's going to be a long struggle. There is a transformation happening. There's a new way of thinking. We are redefining, quote unquote, the problem in America from the problem of crime to the problem of mass incarceration. But it's going to take a long time to unravel this one.
What do you feel like you've learned yourself in the course of doing this work over the last few decades?
Well, you know, it's in the coalition building that you learn a lot of things, right? I mean, understanding on a deeper level the ways in which race and racism continue to manifest in our society, understanding the ways in which it manifests and is driven unconsciously, understanding the ways in which African Americans continue to see its presence and appearance and becoming sympathetic and having a deep understanding, that's been an important evolution for me. I think also in terms of one of the challenges I like the best, you know, we're one of the few movements for freedom and social justice, which is deeply grounded in the sort of progressive end of the spectrum, but which has very powerful alliances on the right wing, especially the libertarian, but not only the libertarian side. Let's face it, not many progressive causes can claim Milton Friedman or William Buckley as major allies.
The legendary conservative economist and the founder of the right-wing National Review.
That's right. I mean, William Buckley, probably the leading conservative intellectual in America in the last third of the 20th century. Milton Friedman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist. You know, George Shultz, the former Republican secretary, actually more or less everything. Frank Carlucci, the former Secretary of Defense and deputy of the CIA. Grover Norquist, he's the one who arranged for me to speak at plenary sessions of CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, the leading right-wing gathering in America. People shouting from the audience, he works for Soros, what's he doing here? But nonetheless, I'm winning a majority of the applause in the debate at CPAC because young conservatives have a libertarian streak and are joining, oftentimes effectively, with young more libertarian-minded people who are progressives, right? So navigating that left-right spectrum, raising money from people both on the left and the right, when I go and talk to people on the right, I remind them of their basic values. Then I appeal to their cost-benefit sensibility. And I say, if in fact spending money on housing or education or drug treatment delivers a better return on your investment than does spending money on incarceration, why does the right wing need to feel it needs to keep locking up people for nonviolent offenses, right? And then I go and talk in left-wing gatherings, and I'll sit there for a day or two. You know something I'll say to my fellow progressives? There's two words I have not heard mentioned the entire 2 days. And what are those words? Liberty and freedom. Well, when you go to progressive gatherings and nobody's using the words liberty and freedom, and somehow those words are being associated as right-wing words, well, wait a second. Then you are abdicating the most core principles of this nation to the right wing. It's crazy and absurd. Yeah. So I'm challenging my allies on the progressive side to embrace these, not just the words, but the meaning. Because in a way, the progressives are fighting for liberty and freedom. But they need to use that language and get serious about it and not just, shy away.
When you're making alliances with people that you might intensely disagree with about some things, but you're working with them on other things, you can do that if you're clear about your values and what you're fighting for. Like, not only can you do that, you have to do it if you want to win a majority in all the places you need to win a majority.
You first of all have to do it because you need to play it straight with all sides. So my body language may shift a bit from one audience to another, a little bit of the phraseology or the way I lay out the arguments, but essentially it's the same argument across the board. So you need to do that first for your own credibility. But secondly, for building a movement, we need to get Republicans to support this. In the state legislatures, Democrats tend to be better than Republicans on most drug policy reform issues, but you can't win without Republican support. So we need to keep crossing over. On the funding, I have to tell you, after Soros, probably of the top 5 or 6 major donors to my organization, the Drug Policy Alliance, probably the 3 of the next 5 are people who are more Republican or on the right wing than on the left wing, right? If I look at the membership of Drug Policy Alliance, it's probably disproportionately people who identify as progressives, but a lot of people who identify as libertarians and sometimes conservatives. So, I think it's pivotal. And I ultimately think that we're appealing to the same underlying values, right? Personal freedom, fairness across individuals and across race as well in America. Responsible use of taxpayers' money is an argument on both sides of this. Keeping families intact, which means not ripping people away and into prison simply because of something they have done. All of those values appeal to both the left and the right.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Ethan Nadelman, on The Good Fight.
Well, thanks so much, and thanks for doing what you're doing.
When you think about it, the drug laws we have are so random, and the inherent racism behind what is legal and what isn't is pretty enlightening. It was really interesting in that last pod where he pointed out that marijuana used to be known as Indian hemp, and they changed the name to marijuana when they made it illegal so people would associate it with Mexican immigrants. I think they said that nearly everyone prosecuted in those early days of the new drug laws were African Americans and Mexicans. Now, it's true that in the Middle Ages and in early modernity, alcohol was an important part of the average peasant's diet. Quite a large percent of their daily caloric intake came from beer and other alcohol. It also performed the important role of helping to sterilize drinking water. It would have been unusual and unsafe to drink water in cities and towns without a healthy portion of alcohol in the mix. Even babies were generally weaned off milk. Is that the right word? Weaned? With a mixture of beer and water? I've actually read a theory that the English obsession with drinking tea helped enable the Industrial Revolution. By the 1800s, tea imports to England were sufficient to make tea cheap enough for the peasants, the working class, the mensch. The process of boiling the tea made nasty drinking water drinkable, without the need for mixing alcohol. So basically the workforce wasn't wasted by lunchtime and they became far more productive. But I digress. Basically, my point is that if Europeans had been smoking marijuana for the last 300 years, and that was the acceptable social lubricant, and alcohol was just discovered today, people started turning up drunk, vomiting, punching on, all that fun stuff, there's no way it'd be legal. It'd be the devil's juice. So put that in your pipe and smoke it, people. Anyway, let's move on. Next up today, what all you seedy freaks have been waiting for since the last show's promo. Not a story about analingus, but almost as good, and crispy too. This is from This American Life 484 Doppelgangers. The you know what's a you know where.
So Fred, you want to do start Act One?
Okay.
Act One, Dead Ringer. We start today with a story of physical resemblance, not of a person, but of a food.
A quick warning that if you're squeamish or averse to graphic images of food, there's going to be some of that in this report.
Here's Ben Calhoun.
I first heard about this whole thing in an email. It came from a listener, a woman named Emily Rancer. She works in the food industry. And the letter Emily wrote was about a story she'd heard from a farmer. The farmer who told her this is apparently a person of some standing in the pork industry. And admittedly, I don't know the first thing about the pork industry. But he's in charge of a pork-producing operation that spans several states. The story he told Emily went something like this. A while ago, he was visiting a pork processing plant in Oklahoma. He's walking through it with a friend, a guy who managed the plant, actually. And at some point, he saw boxes stacked on the floor labeled artificial calamari. He stood there, wondering for a second. And then he asked his friend, "What's artificial calamari?" "Bung," his friend replied. "It's hog rectum. Rectum that would be sliced into rings, deep fried, and boom. There you have it." Okay, if I can, let me just narrate for you what this would mean. It would mean that in restaurants everywhere, right this second, people are squeezing lemon wedges over crispy golden rings, dipping the rings into marinara sauce, and they're eating hog rectum. Now they're chewing, satisfied, and deeply clueless. It's payback. It's payback for our blissful ignorance about where our food comes from and how it gets to us. It's amazing, and it's perfect. But it also seems like it couldn't possibly be true. So I called up the farmer to talk to him personally. I wanted to hear it firsthand. And the farmer confirmed the story. The entire thing. The boxes, the bung. But when I asked him to go on the record, to tape an interview and give his name here on the radio, he very politely declined. Which seems suspicious, right? When I asked him why, he said he'd spoken with his girlfriend about it, and she suggested that he should think about the words that he wanted to come up when somebody Googled his name. This was all fine, though, because he referred me to the real expert, the guy who gave him the tour of the hog processing plant. And that guy, he agreed to talk.
Hello?
Hi, is this Ron?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is Ron Meek. Meat processing plant manager, presently residing in Mountain View, Missouri, where he runs an organic beef processing plant there, called Beyond Organic. If the story really were true, Ron would have been the guy who explained to the farmer what was in those boxes.
The boxes are 10-pound boxes, and they were all, they cut off so much of it, like maybe a 10 or 12-inch piece of the bung, and you know what it looks like? Just looks like after they're cleaned and washed and everything, they just look like a bunch of big noodles in a box is all it looks like.
But the specifically the labels that said imitation calamari, where did you personally see the imitation calamari label.
I've never seen a label say that. That's all I was told by the people that told me that. The people I work for, they told me that.
Oh, the people that you worked for told you that it was used for imitation calamari.
Right.
And is there any possibility that you think that when they were explaining this to you, that they were kind of having you on a little bit?
Having me on?
Yeah, like...
Bullshitting me?
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't think that. But, you know, it could be 5%. Could have been that, you know. But I seriously doubt it.
Okay, just to give a little better picture, a pork bung, and bung is the actual industry term for it, is long and floppy and ugly. At one end, it widens out into this more bulbous shape, like a pink wrinkly pear. That's the rectum. At the other end, it narrows into a soft pinkish-white tube. I know, it sounds gross. But also, consider, we are a nation that eats more than 1 billion pounds of sausage every year. Billion, with a B. Maybe you like liverwurst or capicola or summer sausage with a natural casing. Then you, like me, have eaten bung. Stuffed, dried bung. A lot of brats and Italian sausages are stuffed in intestine, so if you eat those regularly, you pretty much live up the street from bung. So why does the idea of a fried ring of bung just feel grosser? Well, partly it's the visual, right? When you see that little ring of calamari, you don't want to picture it in the context of a pig's behind. Then there are all the people who don't eat pork, period. Ron said there's also another reason.
Just because of the word bung, probably. I mean, people don't just want to jump up and say, man, I'm going to eat me some bung tonight. You know, I mean, that's just the way it is.
But the big question, the question you've been thinking about since we got on this topic, have you or I eaten imitation calamari? Bung dressed up as seafood. Well, Ron didn't know. He said his plant exported a lot of their bung to Asia. But he just didn't know much about whatever happened after it left the door. So he could only speculate. Anything, he said, would be a wild guess. So I turned to people who would know. Is pork bung being falsely peddled as calamari? I called the USDA. The USDA's Food Inspection Service issued the following statement to me. Products we inspect, including those derived from pork, must be accurately labeled and cannot purport to be a product of another species. So, it's against the rules. But people break the rules. A recent study of seafood by a group called Oceana used DNA testing and found that all across the country, fish is regularly being labeled as other species in restaurants and in grocery stores. Escalar sold as white tuna, Pacific rockfish being fraudulently sold as snapper. In Miami, more than 30% of fish was being sold as something it wasn't. In New York, the number was 39%. Boston, 48%. Los Angeles, are you ready? 55%. 55. That means if you order fish in LA, you are most likely eating a species you did not order. In other words, seafood substitution is rampant in this country. And depending on where you live, from what I can tell, you can get cleaned hog bung for about half the price of cleaned squid. So there would be money in it if you could pull off the switch. And as best as I can tell, were you to do this, you would not be caught. A lawyer who's familiar with this area of law and regulation told me, once bung leaves the plant, there's a variety of agencies and entities that would be in play. USDA, FDA, state and local government. But ultimately, he said, the regulation we have is not designed to catch an offense like this. It's aimed mostly at sanitation and food safety. So bottom line, the lawyer said, if somebody wanted to do it, chances are they'd get away with it. So is someone out there doing this? Well, for weeks, I looked for an answer. The USDA says they've never heard of anyone trying to pass pork bung as squid or any other species. I contacted the National Restaurant Association, the National Pork Producers Council, the National Pork Board,
Hello.
A Squid Fishermen's Association,
Good afternoon, National
Cisco,
Pork Board.
And other big food and restaurant supply companies.
It's hog what?
Bung. Hog rectum.
Oh my gosh.
That's the executive director of the California Wetfish Producers Association. But the answer was pretty much always the same. Nobody had heard of it. But almost to a person, they added that that doesn't mean it's not happening somewhere. Ron Meek said a lot of the bung from his plant got exported. So my next call was to the U.S. Meat Export Federation, which confirmed that, quote, the main destinations for pork bungs are China, Hong Kong, Japan, Taiwan, Korea, and the Philippines. They are mainly used for processing, but we are aware of some uses in soups and certain entrees. We are not aware of them being used as a substitute for calamari. But it's not impossible. Unquote. So over the past few weeks, I've called Asian food suppliers, people who live in, work in, and eat in those countries. I talked to a woman named Corrine Trang, who's written an overarching compendium of Asian cuisines. I've talked to academics at NYU and Haverford and USC and Harvard. I've reached out to chefs who know Asian food. The answer, again, always similar. Never heard of it, but it's possible. Partly because bung doesn't have such a complicated reputation in Asia, where it has to be some kind of secret ingredient like it does here. On the other hand, though, people pointed out that in Korea and Japan, you can't get more than a few hours from the ocean. Squid is cheap and it's readily available. You'd only eat a substitute if you wanted the substitute. Generally, people said, if the switch was happening somewhere, they'd guess China. Eventually, I found my way to this guy who I was really excited about, someone who I thought might have my answer. He was, get this, an anthropologist who lived and worked in China for 40 years, where he studied food, and specifically meat. When I talked to him, though, he made two points. Point one, my question about this happening in Asia was racist. Even just asking the question was racist, because it plays on ignorant stereotypes about other cultures eating things that we perceive as weird. Point two was that Ron Meek, my guy from the pig plant, Ron was pulling my leg, and he was getting away with it because I was a dumbass. He told me more than once that I should, quote, find something worthwhile to do with myself. When we ended our conversation, he told me that he was refusing to even dignify what I was doing by appearing on the radio or by letting me use his name. Okay, so to respond to his points one by one. First, am I racist against Asians? Well, I'm half Chinese. My mom's Chinese. Like anyone, I've had the occasional issue with my mother, but this has not been one of them. We grew up eating chicken feet and fish eyes, and I think it's possible to raise the question of who eats what without being racist. His second point, though, that Ron Meek was pulling my leg. I mean, the guy was still an expert on meat in China, so I called Ron back.
All right, shoot me some questions, dude.
I told him the whole thing, about the anthropologist, about what he said. I guess, I mean, the only thing I want to ask you is are you messing with me?
No. I mean, that was what my boss told me. I was like, what the hell do we save these hog bungs for? He says they use them for imitation squid and stuff like that.
But so in your heart of hearts, you believe it?
Yeah, man. I mean, I ain't going to sit here and tell you things that there's bullshit and play with you when I'm just going off of my knowledge of saving hog bungs. I mean, you got to think about how far advanced slaughterhouses are, especially big ones that want to make every penny count. Like the one I worked at, you bring the pigs in, you stun them, then you stick them, and the blood goes off into a trough, and it goes down, and it's vacuum sucked out of there with a vacuum into centrifuges. And they separate the blood from the blood plasma.
Uh-huh.
And they save that. I mean, they save the lungs, they save the pancreas, they save the spleens, they save the heart. The only thing left by the time it's all said and done, is a skull and jawbones. I mean, you can be an anthropologist all you want, and if you don't work in a processing plant, you don't know.
I contacted the plant Ron worked at where this happened, and for what it's worth, they backed him up. They said their sales team had heard of people eating pork bung as imitation calamari, though they hadn't witnessed it firsthand or heard it directly from a customer. It was all hearsay. So at the end of all this, I still had no proof that anyone was passing off bung as squid. And then I realized I hadn't asked the more basic question here. Could bung do it? Could it pass as calamari? And that question led me to a guy named Eddie Lin. Eddie Lin has eaten a lot of bung. At least 100 times, he said, probably more. Eddie has an extreme food blog called Deep End Dining and an online TV show called Kamikaze Kitchen.
I can definitely see a resemblance texture-wise.
Oh, really?
Yeah, definitely. There's sort of a rubbery texture, sort of like a calamari.
Huh.
But you would really have to get rid of that, you know, needless to say, foul flavor and odor from the bung.
Somehow I hadn't figured that the bung, once it was scrubbed and rinsed and cleaned with steam, that it would still taste like, you know.
So, you would definitely have to do some major, major blanching.
Uh-huh.
or brining. I meant brining, yeah.
Uh-huh. To try and leach those flavors out of there.
Yeah, I mean, those flavors have been, marinating in that pig for quite a while, so.
A lifetime.
Yeah.
He thought it wouldn't be easy, but he thought it could be done. And there was only one way to tell if he was right, to cook up some bung and eat it. And if the taste was overwhelming and the texture was all wrong, well, then I'd have my answer. And at this point, I'll be frank, I started to root for the bung. I realized that this is not a story about fraud. It's not a bait-and-switch story. It's a story about possibility. It's classic rags to riches. It's about whether a cut of meat, perhaps the lowliest, most malignable cut of meat in America, might somehow, in at least one place on the planet, be dipped in the redemptive oils of the great culinary equalizer that is the deep fryer. And it might emerge transformed, no longer an outcast, but instead, hair combed, clean shaven, in a suit and tie. It might walk reborn onto a table. Through sheer force of resemblance, it might be loved. Its history, years of drudgery and hardship, doing the body's least glamorous job, all washed away. No, this is not the story of a con man like Bernie Madoff. It's Pretty Woman. This is whether Goodwill Hunting finds his way out of Southie. It's whether Charlie, on that very last chocolate bar, really can get a golden ticket. To do all this, to try it, I called my little sister, Lauren. She's a chef, trained abroad at the Cordon Bleu, worked at Michelin star restaurants. She's that kind of chef. Soon we were standing in front of a deli case, and I don't know why I feel hesitant about saying this, because I don't think it's racist. It was in Chinatown.
Pork bung, there it is. Look at it, it looks like a sphincter.
Wait, what do you mean it looks like a...
This one up here that's cut up, it looks like a butthole.
And Lauren had theories about pulling it off. Brining, soaking, maybe braising. But once we got to the store, once she'd seen the meat up close, her doubts got worse.
I think after looking at it, I don't think it's gonna...
You don't think it's gonna work?
No. It's too thick. There's too much muscle tissue. It's too thick. You'd have to use like a ring cutter to make it the right thickness.
What do you think those bits are in there?
Oh, you know, poo.
My sister said Eddie Lin was definitely right. The giveaway would be the stubborn flavor of poo. That flavor, she said, it's tough to get rid of. The earth revolves around the sun, and bung will always taste like But there was no backing out now. We would eat. We would eat our way to the truth. And so what if it didn't look good? So what if bung was destined to taste like bung? You know who it didn't look good for, and he still put up a fight? Rocky Balboa. That's who. This was it. The bung versus calamari. Squid versus tail. The rumble in the bunghole. We set up the tasting at a restaurant, in the lull between lunch and dinner. In the dining room, there was just a few tables eating, and all around the restaurant, the morning shift was wrapping up, as we walked in with a red cooler filled with squid and hog bung. So originally, I'd recruited some half a dozen people from our office at This American Life as tasters. The final group the day of the tasting included, from the office, Seth Lind and Brian Reed.
So when's the last time that you guys had calamari?
I had calamari probably like a month ago.
And what about you, Brian?
I haven't had it since we like got this tip about the possible.
Oh my gosh, have you been avoiding?
Yeah, no, totally. And like to be honest, like I ate calamari pretty you know, I'm like a regular eater of calamari. Like not like all the time, but like it's something I'll routinely order if it's on an appetizer menu, you know. Yeah. I mean, I grew up in like an Italian American family where like my grandparents were also born here. I feel like calamari is just big among that sector of people at like, you know, Olive Garden and stuff like that. So I just grew up eating it, you know.
I hadn't realized this. For weeks, Brian had been avoiding calamari. He'd been living in fear.
Brian, if you find out that they're indiscernible from each other, will you ever eat calamari again?
No, I don't think so. That's why I want to do this. Just to know going forward.
Back in the kitchen, things were looking bad. I'd given up on the idea that bung would taste the same as calamari. Now I'd hung my hopes on the idea that at least visually it would look the same. But as my sister dropped the floured rings of hog bung into the fryer, they had turned into this kind of big, ugly, tangled wad. Nothing like the jiggly squid rings.
Oh, they're very, like, scraggly looking.
But then, as if by a miracle, they changed. My sister gave a shake to the fry basket, and as they sizzled, the bung just seemed to gracefully snap into rings.
Oh, look at that, though. It's like magic. They're, like, turning into circles.
Yeah. So I'm going to pull these first ones.
Soon, we were face-to-face with the plate. On it, there were two piles of rings, similar in size, similar in shape. The bung had more of a frizzly edge to it, kind of like a fancy onion ring. The calamari was smoother.
Okay, so
I asked Seth and Brian to just give a first impression.
I have a guess, but I could it's one of those things where you're pretty sure, but you could totally be wrong.
God, I thought I would be more sure. I'm waffling now. My gut reaction is that this was calamari and this was not.
Okay, before you eat it, yeah. See, I totally thought this was calamari, the other one.
Okay.
So I'm going to do it at the same time.
Okay, so just to be clear what's going on here. Seth has chosen one pile of rings, which he thinks is calamari. Brian has done the same thing, only Brian is choosing the other stack of fried rings.
Okay, so we're about to bite into these simultaneously, which we both think this is calamari.
But they're the opposite ones.
Okay.
So, in actuality, Seth is right. Seth is eating calamari. The chewing you hear from Brian's mic, that is the sound of a calamari lover eating fried pig rectum. I should also add, there were actually two varieties of bung on the plate that day. One bung that my sister had blanched over and over to mellow any organy fecal flavor. And then untreated, straight-up bung. Unfiltered, unchained, uncut, 100% pure bung. That one, the latter one, bung at its purest, at the height of its bunginess. This is what Brian was eating. As they ate, Seth still looked confident.
I think I was right.
Really?
Yeah. I totally think I was right.
Game, set, match, bung. And it wasn't just Brian. I thought so. Damien, who manages the restaurant, he also thought it was passable. A few of us picked up a faint flavor of pork rind, but if you weren't really looking for it, you wouldn't notice it was there. One of the restaurant staff, a guy named Ethan Van Buren, had the simplest, clearest explanation.
I think that when you slice something up really thin and deep fried, it's going to taste like something that's been deep fried.
If a plate full of the bun came out, how many people do you think would even... do you think you'd notice if you were in that setting?
I'd say top scenario is somebody says, this calamari tastes funny, and keeps eating it.
And as for Brian...
I agree with that.
Oh, Brian. Brian was reeling a bit, trying to figure out anymore. Just what this was going to mean for him.
I'm sure I've been fooled in the past. I'm just, sure of it.
Wait, you're thinking that you've been places in the past and you've had bunk?
I just imagine, seeing a plate that looks like that with this food that looks like this on it, sitting with my family growing up. We definitely have eaten something that tasted like this and just thought it was calamari, for sure.
Not only wasn't he sure if he'd ever eat calamari again, he didn't want to eat the calamari on the plate in front of him. Calamari, I guaranteed him, was real. Just to repeat one last time, I have no proof that anyone, anywhere, has ever tried to pass off pork bung as calamari in a restaurant. All I know is, if you wanted to do it, it would be easy. And I'm choosing to believe that it's happening somewhere. Because at some point in working on this story, I stopped identifying with Brian and anyone who might feel ripped off or grossed out by getting imitation instead of the real thing. Now, I identify with the bung. And I'd like to think that somewhere out there, right now, under a heat lamp, a platter is sitting. It's warm, and it's full of promise and transformation and redemption. That's the world that I'll choose to live in. For me, for you, for the bung. For the bung in all of us.
Ben Calhoun, he's one of the producers of our program. Thanks to the restaurant Aurora in Brooklyn for letting us use their kitchen for our taste test.
We hope you think of us next time you're enjoying some nice golden calamari. We've got one more short pod for you today. It's by Russell Brand, the comedian, but not as you probably know him. Turns out he's pretty damn sharp and articulate. Here he discusses his new role as the guest editor for New Statesman magazine, his views on voting, and the politics of status quo. Russ pretty much hits on every dodgy state practice there is, and he absolutely nails it. One of the reasons I wanted to do this show was to get this kind of stuff out there. It's passionate and thought-provoking and worth a listen. The following interview with Jeremy Paxman is available on YouTube in entirety, but we have taken excerpts from Smells Like Human Spirit podcast number 103, Never Voted, Never Will. Mostly just the Brand interview and some brief commentary by that pod's host on Brand's other recent appearances. We've included links to both in the show notes. Listen to the interviewer try to undermine Brand's big picture arguments at every turn, but he stays on point.
Jeremy, don't ask me to sit here in an interview with you in a bloody hotel room and devise a global utopian system. I'm merely pointing out that the
current...
You're
calling for revolution.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm calling for change. I'm calling for genuine alternatives. I say when there is a genuine alternative, a genuine option, then vote for that. But until then, don't bother. Why pretend? Why be complicit in this ridiculous illusion?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 103 of the Smells Like Human Spirit podcast. I am your usual host, Guy Evans, broadcasting to you from New York. And in today's show, I'm going to be breaking down the Russell Brand interview with Jeremy Paxman, which was broadcast on the BBC Newsnight program earlier this week, an interview that's generated a lot of discussion, particularly online, and really kind of struck a chord with me. So that's what I'll be covering for today's show. Now, I'd like to start with discussing my thoughts on our subject, Russell Brand, in general. Now, I have to admit, I'm not too familiar with his acting and with his comedy and things of that nature, but his recent MSNBC appearance and his speech at the GQ award show really put him on a lot of people's radar, I think. People who maybe don't follow him in terms of his professional work, but recognize that he's really starting to speak out about some real injustices and some very important issues that I think relate to all people, not just people in his line of work or in his social circles. Something else that he did that really kind of grabbed my attention was his testimony to the Parliamentary Committee on Drugs, which took place in April 2012. And I remember the day when randomly I came across this video in YouTube of Russell Brand giving testimony to this this committee, as I say, on drugs. And I thought, this must be kind of a farcical appearance. It's probably just making a mockery of the whole subject. So you can imagine my surprise when I started to watch this clip and realize what an eloquent, articulate, thoughtful man that this individual Russell Brand seemed to be. He was making some excellent points. He was taking the event seriously. And I'm going to play a clip of that right now so you guys can hear for yourself.
I became a drug addict, I think, because of emotional difficulties, psychological difficulties, and perhaps a spiritual malady. For me, taking drugs and excessive drinking were the result of a psychological, spiritual, or mental condition. So they're symptomatic. I was like sad, lonely, unhappy, detached, and drugs and alcohol for me seemed like a solution to that problem. Once I dealt with the emotional, spiritual, mental impetus, I no longer felt the need to take drugs or use drugs.
And so, in giving evidence to this parliamentary committee, Russell Brand was able to use his considerable platform and popularity to convey some very important messages and lessons for young people and anyone really who listens to what he has to say. Which brings me on to the Jeremy Paxman interview. Now, I'm going to play the full audio of this interview.
Russell Brand, who are you to edit a political magazine?
Well, I suppose like a person who's being politely asked by an attractive woman. I don't know what the typical criteria is. I don't know many people that edit political magazines. Boris, he used to do one, didn't he? So I'm a person with crazy hair, quite a good sense of humour. Don't know much about politics. I'm ideal.
Okay, so right off the bat, it's important to give things some context here. Brand was offered the position of guest editor at the New Statesman, which is a British political magazine. The magazine describes its mission as the following. Irreverent, beautifully written, and witty, The New Statesman is the essential read for bright thinkers everywhere. It is Britain's leading, best-written, and most authoritative weekly political, cultural, and current affairs magazine. And Brand got things started with a treatise, if you will, on revolution, which you can read at newstatesman.com, where he does in fact say that he was offered the position of guest editor by a beautiful woman and therefore could not resist. He had to accept. Let's get back to the interview.
But is it true you don't even vote?
Yeah, no, I don't vote.
Well, how do you have any authority to talk about politics then?
Well, I don't get my authority from this pre-existing paradigm, which is quite narrow and only serves a few people. I look elsewhere for alternatives that might be of service to humanity. Alternate means alternate political systems.
They being?
Well, I've not invented it yet, Jeremy. I had to do a magazine last week. I've had a lot on my plate. But I say, but here's the thing it shouldn't do. Shouldn't destroy the planet. Shouldn't create massive economic disparity. Shouldn't ignore the needs of the people. The burden of proof is on the people with the power, not people like doing a magazine.
Now, Brand explained further his standpoint, or his viewpoint, I should say, towards voting in the piece he wrote for The New Statesman. He says in this article, "I have never voted. Like most people, I am utterly disenchanted by politics. Like most people, I regard politicians as frauds and liars, and the current political system is nothing more than a bureaucratic means for furthering the augmentation and advantages of economic elites. Billy Connolly said, don't vote, it encourages them, and the desire to be a politician should buy you for life from ever being one." Let's carry on.
How do you imagine that people get power?
Well, I imagine there are sort of hierarchical systems that have been preserved through generations.
They get power by being voted in.
Well, you
that's
say that,
how
Jeremy,
you can't even be asked to vote.
It's quite a narrow prescriptive parameter that changes within the
democracy, that's how it works.
Well, I don't think it's working very well, Jeremy, given that the planet is being destroyed, given that there is economic disparity of a huge degree. What are you saying? There's no alternative. There's no alternative.
No, I'm not saying
system.
That. I'm saying if you can't be asked to vote, why should we be asked to listen to your political point of view?
You don't have to listen to my political point of view, but it's not that I'm not voting out of apathy. I'm not voting out of absolute indifference and weariness and exhaustion from the lies, treachery, deceit of the political class that has been going on for generations now, and which has now reached fever pitch, where we have a disenfranchised, disillusioned, despondent underclass that are not being represented by that political system. So voting for it is tacit complicity with that system, and that's not something I'm offering up.
Well, why don't you change it then?
I'm trying to.
Well, why don't you start by voting?
I don't think it works. People have voted already, and that's what's created the current paradigm.
When did you last vote?
Never.
You've never, ever voted?
No. Do you think that's really bad?
So you struck an attitude, what, before the age of 18?
Well, I was busy being a drug addict at that point, because I come from the kind of social conditions that are exacerbated by an indifferent system that really just administrates for large corporations and ignores the population that it was voted in to serve.
Wow, this was the moment in the interview when I really started to stand up and say, this is pretty incredible, some of the content of Russell Brand's presentation here. I just want to quote directly from what he said there. He says, "I come from the kind of social conditions that are exacerbated by an indifferent system that really just administrates for large corporations and ignores the population it was voted in to serve." Is there a more succinct and powerful summary that anyone could offer up for the situation that we have? Just incredible. Also, I was very much entertained by the logical fallacy that Paxman kept attempting to push on us there, saying that, you know, how do you think that people get into power? They get voted by the people. So if the people don't like it, they only have themselves to blame. At least that was the implication, because they're the ones who put these leaders in power. The reason I say it's a logical fallacy is because if you think about it, essentially we get presented with a bunch of different candidates and then we're told to vote for them. Now, you can argue that to get in that position where you're a candidate for president or prime minister, you have to rise through the ranks. You have to first serve local communities and then perhaps counties, states, and so on. And then you become maybe a candidate to lead a nation. But of course, you know, that's how it should work in theory, but in practice it doesn't, because of the influence of lobbyists and because of money and all the money that's in politics. It doesn't really work that way. And of course, you have to conform to the existing paradigm to even get into that position. If you come into a political party and you have some really radical ideas and you want to shake things up a little bit, well, they're not going to support you in your bid to rise to prominence, as it were. And if you want to be an independent, because of the lack of media coverage and resources, your voice is probably never going to get heard. And therefore, the same paradigm and same system is reinforced time and time again. So I really enjoyed Russell Brand's comments here, and Jeremy Paxman, as ever, was quite entertaining. Let's return to the interview, because it's really starting to heat up.
Blaming the political class of the fact you had a drug problem?
No. I'm saying I was part of a social and economic class that is underserved by the current political system, and drug addiction is one of the problems it creates when you have huge, underserved, impoverished populations. People get drug problems and also don't feel like they want to engage with the current political system, because they see that it doesn't work for them. They see that it makes no difference. They see that they're not served.
Well, of course it doesn't work for them if they don't bother to vote.
Jeremy, my darling, I'm not saying that the apathy doesn't come from us, the people. The apathy comes from the politicians. They are apathetic to our needs. They're only interested in servicing the needs of corporations. Look at what... Ain't the Tories going to court and to taking the EU to court because they're trying to curtail bank bonuses? Is that what's happening at the moment in our country? It is, isn't it?
Yeah, there is.
So what am I going to tune in for that?
I just want to return really quickly to the article that Brand wrote for the New Statesman, where he kind of expands on his position again in terms of not voting. He says, "I don't vote because to me it seems like a tacit act of compliance. I know my grandparents fought in 2 World Wars and 1 World Cup so that I'd have the right to vote. Well, they were conned. As far as I'm concerned, there is nothing to vote for. I feel it is a more potent political act to completely renounce the current paradigm than to participate in even the most trivial and tokenistic manner by obediently crossing a little box. Total revolution of consciousness and our entire social, political, and economic system is what interests me, but that's not on the ballot." Well said indeed. He also references, and again, this is a real story that he references here, the fact that the Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, taking legal action against the EU over their proposed move to cap the bonuses of thousands of British-based bankers. And he says, why would I tune in for that? Why would I take an interest when they're more concerned about bankers' bonuses than, I don't know, making sure that everyone has enough to eat, for example, making sure that their basic needs are covered and we have a fair and just social system. Okay, back to the clip.
You don't believe in democracy. No, you want a revolution, don't you?
The planet is being destroyed. We are creating an underclass. We are exploiting poor people all over the world. And the genuine, legitimate problems of the people are not being addressed by our political class.
All of those things may be true.
They are true.
But you took... I wouldn't argue with you about many of them.
Well, how come I feel so cross with you? It can't just be because of that beard. It's gorgeous.
It's possibly because...
And if the Daily Mail don't want it, I do. I'm against them. Grow it longer. Tangle it into your armpit hair.
You are a very trivial man.
What do you think? I am trivial?
Yes.
A minute ago, you were having a go at me because I want a revolution. Now
no,
I'm trivial.
I'm asking, no,
I'm
but,
bouncing
but
about
I'm not having
place.
A go at you because you want a revolution. Many Good. People want a revolution, but I'm asking you what it would be like.
Well, I think what it won't be like is a huge disparity between rich and poor, where 300 Americans have the same amount of wealth as the 85 million poorest Americans, where there is an exploited and underserved underclass that are being continually ignored, where welfare is slashed while Cameron and Osborne go to court to defend the rights of bankers to continue receiving their bonuses. That's all I'm saying.
What's the scheme? That's all I'm asking. What's the scheme? You talk vaguely about revolution. What is it?
I think a socialist egalitarian system based on the massive redistribution of wealth, heavy taxation of corporations and massive responsibility for energy companies and any company that's exploiting the environment, I think they should be... I think the very concept of profit should be hugely reduced. David Cameron says profit isn't a dirty word. I say profit is a filthy word because wherever there is profit, there is also deficit. And this system currently doesn't address these ideas. And so why would anyone vote for it? Why would anyone be interested in it?
Who would levy these taxes?
I think we do need to, like, there needs to be a centralised administrative system, but built on...
Yes, there needs to be a government.
Well, we might maybe call it something else. Call them, like, the admin bods, right. So they don't get
And how would they be chosen?
Jeremy, don't ask me to sit here in an interview with you in a bloody hotel room and devise a global utopian system. I'm merely pointing out that the
You're
current...
You're calling for revolution.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm calling for change. I'm calling for genuine alternatives.
But there are many people who would agree with you.
Good.
The current system is not engaging with all sorts of problems. Yes. And they feel apathetic. Mm. Really apathetic.
Yes.
But if they were to take you seriously and not to vote...
Yeah, they shouldn't vote. They should. That's one thing they should do. Don't bother voting. Because then when it reaches... There's a point. So these little valves, these sort of like little cosy little valves of recycling and Prius and like, you know, turn up somewhere, it stops us reaching the point where we think, oh, this is enough now. Stop voting. Stop pretending. Wake up. Be in reality now. Time to be in reality now. Why vote? We know it's not going to make any difference. We know that already. So, you know,
it
I have more impact at West Ham United, cheering them on. And they lost the city, unnecessarily, Saturday.
OK, well, now you're being facetious.
Well, facetiousness has as much value as seriousness. I think you're making the mistake of mistaking seriousness
for solemnity.
You're
not going to solve world problems by facetiousness. That's...
We're not going to solve them with the current system. At least facetiousness is funny.
Sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes, Jeremy. So listen, so let's approach this optimistically. You've spent your whole career berating and haranguing politicians, and then when, sort of like me, a comedian goes, yeah, they're all worthless, what's the point in engaging with any of them? You sort of have a go at me because I'm not poor anymore.
Well, no, I'm not having a go at you about that. I'm just asking you why we should take you seriously when you're so unspecific.
You don't have to take... Well, firstly, I don't mind if you take me seriously. I'm here just to draw attention to a few ideas. I just want to have a little bit of a laugh. I'm saying there are people with alternative ideas that are far better qualified than I am, and far better qualified, more importantly, than the people that are currently doing that job. Because they're not attempting to solve these problems. They're not. They're attempting to placate the population. The measures that are currently being taken around climate change are indifferent, will not solve the problem.
It's possible as human beings they're simply overwhelmed by the scale of the problem.
Not really. Well, possibly. It might be that. I mean, but that's sort of just semantics, really. Whether they're overwhelmed by it or tacitly maintaining it because of habitual life. I mean, like, mate, this is what I noticed when I was in the Houses of Parliament. It's decorated exactly the same as Eton. It's decorated exactly the same as Oxford. So a certain type of people goes in there and thinks, oh, this makes me nervous. And another type of people go in there and go, this is how it should be. And I think that's got to change now. We can no longer have erroneous, duplicitous systems held in place unless it's for the only systems that serve the planet and serve the population of the planet can be allowed to survive. Not ones that serve elites, be they political or corporate elites. And this is what's currently happening.
You don't really believe that.
I completely believe it. Don't look at me all weary, like, well, you're at a fireside with a pipe in your beard.
Ed Miliband was an elite.
Well, he went to the same primary school as Boris, though, didn't he?
He did, but he then went to a comprehensive school in North London.
Well, that's very good. That's all well and good. But what I'm saying is that within the existing paradigm, the change is not dramatic enough, not radical enough. So you can well understand public disturbances and public dissatisfaction when there are not genuine changes and genuine alternatives being offered. I say when there is a genuine alternative, a genuine option, then vote for that. But until then, don't bother. Why pretend? Why be complicit in this ridiculous illusion?
Because by the time somebody comes along, you might think it worth voting for, it may be too late.
I don't think so, because the time is now. These movements are already occurring. It's happening everywhere. We're in a time where communication is instantaneous, and there are communities all over the world. The Occupy movement made a difference, even if only in that it introduced to the popular public lexicon the idea of the 1% versus the 99%. People, for the first time in a generation, are aware of massive corporate and economic exploitation. These things are not nonsense, and these subjects are not being addressed. No one's doing anything about tax havens. No one's doing anything about the political affiliations and financial affiliations of the Conservative Party. So until people start addressing things that are actually real, why wouldn't I be facetious? Why would I take it seriously? Why would I encourage a constituency of young people that are absolutely indifferent to vote? Why would we? Aren't you bored? Aren't you more bored than anyone? Ain't you been talking to them year after year, listening to their lies, their nonsense? Then it's this one gets in, then it's that one get in. But the problem continues. Why are we going to continue to contribute to this facade?
I'm surprised you can be facetious when you're that angry about it.
Yeah, I am angry. I am angry. Because for me, it's real. Because for me, it's not just some peripheral thing that I turn up once in a while to a church fate for. For me, this is what I come from. This is what I care about.
Do you see any hope?
Remember that? Yeah, totally. There's going to be a revolution. It's totally going to happen. I think not only I ain't got a flicker of doubt. This is the end. This is time to wake up. I remember I see you in that programme where you look at your ancestors and you saw that while your grandmother had to brass herself or got fucked over by the aristocrats who ran her gaff, you cried because you knew that it was unfair and unjust. And that was, what was that, a century ago? That's happening to people now. I just come from a woman who's being treated like that. I've just been talking to a woman today who's being treated like that. So if we can engage that feeling, instead of some moment of lachrymose sentimentality trotted out on the TV for people to pour over emotional porn, if we can engage that feeling and change things, why wouldn't we? Why is that naive? Why is that not my right because I'm an actor? I mean, I've taken the right. I don't need the right from you. I don't need the right from anybody. I'm taking it.
Boom. I'm taking it. Personally, I found that shit massively profound. Profundity rating off the scale, mainly because it was the last thing I was expecting when I first downloaded it. I love getting angry and riled up listening to idiots, so when I saw Russell Brand, never voted, never will, I thought I'd have a laugh at some limey comedian dropping a few jokes and glorifying apathy and disempowerment. Wrong again, bang, wrong again. To quote Rusty, I'm not voting out of an absolute indifference and weariness and exhaustion from the lies, treachery, deceit of the political class that has been going on for generations now and has now reached fever pitch, where we have a disenfranchised, disillusioned, despondent underclass that is not being represented by that political system. So voting for it is tacit complicity with that system, and that's not something I'm offering up. Wow, nice one. Just to be clear, if you actually give a shit what I think, I still don't advocate not voting. I believe voting is important. Unless you have a platform like this guy where you can turn not voting into a valid political statement, an admirable stance of passive resistance, unless you can do that, then it's silly not to vote. I get that option A is the same as option B, and that is messed up, but being pragmatic, rarely are they identical. There's always, at worst, a better bad option, always one option slightly more open to change. The major political party's main interest is always to stay or to get into power, so any and all policies are secondary to that goal. If they believe a critical mass of voters want something to change, then it's political suicide to ignore that issue. So, vote early, vote often, be vocal about what you want from your representatives, be the change. Okay, hold on. Just climbing down from a soapbox. Okay, alright, that's it for this week, guys. Thanks for listening. Thanks for downloading the show. Part 2 of our Dodgy Practices trilogy. Special treat for you guys. Governor will be hosting. Hear one of our favourite This American Life episodes of all time, the 400-pound CEO. Hear about Big Pharma suppressing data. Hear about Rockefeller, Mr. Big Oil 1.0. And lastly, a morally ambiguous tale about hitting back at those Nigerian scammers. Hitting back hard. That's next time on Mosh Pod. Now, don't run off just yet. Since it's gone all political anyway, I want to share a song with you. It's called A Distant Sense of Random Menace from the album of the same name, by Earth Boy. That's with a U, so it's U-R-T-H Boy, all one word. He's also the lead dude of the Aussie hip-hop band The Herd. I emphatically encourage everyone to check out their shit. It's political, and his scalpel-sharp lyrics slice into the self-indulgent, shallow materialism that pervades music and most entertainment these days. As the name suggests, it's all about the distant evil shit that goes down outside the comfort of our little first world. Constant war, famine, poverty, disease, injustice, genocide. It's all happening to our fellow human beings right now. But it doesn't feel real. We don't get enraged. It's all just a distant sense of random menace. Now really, it's just a fluke that any of us listening to this won the geo-economic lottery and ended up here rather than there. Far out. I've got to be careful with all this. Once I get started, I bang on and on, hence the name. I could bang on about if it's an integral part of human nature to pay attention to your tribe, your quote-unquote tribe, than the other, you know, outsiders. And that empathy seems to dissipate relative to distance and otherness. I could bang on about how I think it is, or should be, more about capacity. Capacity to care and capacity to assist. But the main thing, the scary thing, the most important thing to know is that shit changes. Shit happens. It's not just a bumper sticker, it's just history repeating. There will come a time, hopefully not in my lifetime, because I certainly don't want to deal with this shit, when the tables will turn, something will go down, and we will be the desperate, the hungry, the war-ravaged. We will be the refugees drowning in leaky boats as we try and save our families, while some fleabag country debates over whether they really want to let Whitey in or not. Ah, I could go on and on. Sorry, guys. Okay, over to Earth Boy.
Earth Boy in the house.
Come on, come all, join in us. It's all. Sense. Some random menace. You know, it's out there. And this is this. Watch out for them randoms. Maybe it's too complicated. Maybe it's a minefield. Maybe it's like someone else's murder. It's not quite real. Buried page 10 of today's paper. Read about another road rage of a crazed teenager. The mother gives the box grab, saying she's just sad. And all the justice in the world won't bring her daughter back. Flavor of the 48 hours till the news finds another utter tragedy to increase the views. You still never know if you've reached the truth. 30 seconds to a minute and you're in it up to the tips of your toes. And the truth can be a dodgy uncle. Media moguls and leaders act like Simon and Garfunkel. The right wing squawks for yet more hawks, and the left wing calls for yet more peace talks. And many people left are asking who to believe, cause reality is as muddy as token olive leaves. And apparently you can't wear your heart on your sleeve, cause the menace is too distant for listeners to grieve. And even I've been numb to the cartoon alternative, just trying to learn to live. It's like, it's just a distant sense of randomness. Just a distant sense of randomness. It's just a distant sense of random menace. Try as I might, I cannot get my head around the hoodoo slaughtering the Tutsis in Rwanda 1994. And then on top to comprehend how the United Nations let it happen with their blue helmets armed by the door. 800,000 in less than 90 days. Zapica just too far away. Where's the genocide convention only mentioned in connection with the Nazis and the Jews during World War II? Cause your worldview seen through the same view that drew their bloody colonial maps. For custodial tax, historical pacts, treaties and age-old arrangements ignored in order for the dominant order to be restored. Warlords, cause dictators, puppet regimes installed. While cold wars and old world default. Wars on drugs and wars on terror. Later on there'll be concessions made by governments of intelligence errors. Is to understand and simplify. Black and white, good and bad. Learn not to sympathize unless it's of an allied flag. I'll be damned if my land is a 51st state. Both the realists and idealists on the same day. Like, it's just a distant sense of randomness. Just a distant sense of randomness. It's not a soapbox, or at least I hope not. These are things that affect me so much, they're what I dream of. Dream of different endings where lessons are learned. Before good and bad were copyright, foreign policy terms. Before hip-hop was either barbecue or bling. Before it seemed like everyone was operated by string. So align yourself, define yourself, design yourself. With any luck, your life will all work out. And you won't find yourself the victim of an effort to ethnically cleanse. Left to defend the rest of these men, women and children. From rape, pillage and killing, cause every evil got its coalition of the goddamn willing. So forgive me if I can't give you something to laugh to. This is for you to argue, shake your mind and ask to. It's for me to ask you, just who can we trust? Dust to dust, and if tomorrow is us, what if tomorrow is us? Cause you know that tomorrow is us. And what if tomorrow is us? It's just a distant sense of randomness. A distant sense of randomness. San Salvador. It's just a distant sense of randomness. It's just a distant sense of randomness. It's just a distant sense of randomness.